You're listening to Irish Radio Canada's Woman Abroad, and I have the wonderful honour of having a chat with a member of the Order of Manitoba, the Order of Canada, a Knight of the National Order of Arts and Letters in the Republic of France, a composer of original music for The Merchant of Venice and the Stratford Festival of Canada in 2001, and a whole variety of other musical compositions, in addition to Grammy Awards, North American Folk Alliance Awards, Juno Awards, and Billboard International Achievement Awards. And I could keep going on, but I wouldn't get time to have a chat if I did with Lorena McKennett. Lorena, thank you so much for coming along for a chat.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to join you.
Manitoba, I mentioned it first because you're Manitoba born.
Mm-hmm.
And I then mentioned Canada because you're now an Ontario resident and you involved down in Stratford. A musical career that is recognised. And what impressed me was your European flavour, your Alhambra, Italy, Ireland. And you, how you have drawn on the Celtic roots of our humanity in many ways and our spirituality. What drew you there?
Well, it's quite a long journey. It's been a wonderful, rich journey, I would say. My roots go back to prairie town in Manitoba called Morden. My father was a livestock dealer and my mother a nurse. And there wasn't much music around our house, but my mother enrolled me into piano lessons at the age of 5. And that teacher made it a prerequisite that all our students were part of a choir, a children's choir. So I started singing in that capacity before I could read music or read, words, etc. You know, to escalate the story, shall we say, I came to fall in love with folk music, but it was more North American folk music in the 70s, Simon and Garfunkel, Peter, Paul and Mary, Leonard Cohen, Joni Mitchell, etc. But it wasn't until I moved to Winnipeg in the late 70s that I found myself in a folk club, which there were members from Ireland, Scotland and England. And it was structured in one of those traditional sessions where people brought their vinyl and we learned tunes from each other and sang and we changed around the order of our contributions. And it was at that time I became smitten by what I would, you know, it was traditional Celtic music, but it was really much more Irish and Scots. There was a bit of that was predominantly what it was. And I was really it was like an involuntary reaction, less a thoughtful one or an intellectual one that said, my family came from Scotland and then to Donegal and then to Canada. But rather, there's something very, very infectious in the, particularly the Irish and the Scottish, and I would say even more the Irish traditional music that has struck many people all around the world. So I maintain over the years that I've been trading, shall we say, the basis has been something that has been incredibly powerful. In 1990, I attended an I'll go back for a minute because when I moved to Stratford in 81, I also took a course in Irish history because I felt it was really important to get a feeling for the context in which folk music sprang. And so I took a course in Irish history, particularly from 1800, from the Act of Union onward, and I immersed myself in it. So by the time I took my first trip to Ireland around 1981, I went to different parts of the West Coast, but I particularly anchored myself in County Clare and Doolin and Listowel-Varna. It was really a very impactful experience. But the next big part of the journey occurred around 1991, when I attended an exhibition in Venice that was the most extensive exhibition ever assembled on the Celts. And that a lot of artifacts that had been sort of hovering in the former Soviet bloc countries became part of this exhibition. And the thrust of it was that the Celts were much more than this mad collection of anarchists from Scotland, Ireland, and Wales and Brittany and so on. But they were this vast collection of tribes that had fanned out across Europe and into Asia Minor and dated back to 500 BC. And that was a juncture of my career because I looked over to the traditional groups like the Bothy Band and Plangstae and so on. I felt, and Mary Black, I felt they were performing and engaging in the traditional music far better than I could. And I thought, okay, I'm going to start looking at the history of these Celts and travel to as many places as I could and embark upon a creative exercise that those travels and that history was a springboard for my creativity. So that really is it in a nutshell. And I'm sorry if even that was too long.
not at all. And, you know, we opened up with a bright May morning, and this is hopefully a bright May morning that we have across the country. And when you talk in terms of the music, the Bothy Band, Mary Black, and the richness of it, how that reached into your soul and that it inspired you then to take that on as part of, in many ways, helps define you.
Well, it's foundational. I mean, it is truly foundational. I remember that first year in Doolin and February. And in fact, I was actually working towards creating a one-woman performance piece based on the Irish coming to Canada during the famine. And I was doing research in the library and so on. But I remember those days hearing Mary Black's, I think, Anarchy Gordon, and it was just punishing just how beautiful it was. And all the music. And then it was, you know, I mean, I love and I knew the chieftains as well. There was something extraordinarily special and unique. It wasn't just dry traditional music. It was infused with something incredibly special. And as I say, it was absolutely foundational for me when I heard all that music. And it was an involuntary reaction. And I had such, and still have such respect for all the people who played that music or who's still with us, Donald Lenny and so on. So I feel very grateful, to be honest. And I felt very self-conscious, to be honest, too, that although I was drawn to it and wanted to kind of engage in it, I actually felt that I couldn't perhaps perform it with the authenticity that it needed, and it needed really Irish people performers to do that. So I've always been a bit self-conscious of performing some of that traditional repertoire in that way, while still feeling greatly indebted to those people.
Well, as somebody who has sat and enjoyed your performance at Godrich last year, and has enjoyed your music, I don't think you have anything to be self-conscious about in how you interpret and perform any of those. What brought you, or how did you get out to busking on Grafton Street?
Well, it was a connection. I worked on music in 1984 for a production of Two Gentlemen of Verona here in Stratford at the festival, a Shakespearean festival. And the director, Leon Rubin, who was actually from England, had been invited to direct a play at the Abbey Theatre for the millennium, the era of the floozy and the jacuzzi. And so he asked me to come over and compose music for that production as well and perform it live in that production, as I had here in Stratford for Two Gentlemen Verona. I composed the music and I performed it live with a harp and sometimes the accordion and bow and whatever else. And so I was parked there in Dublin for, I don't know, a couple months or something. And I lived out there and stayed in a bed and breakfast all that time in Dunleary, and I had a bicycle and I would cycle into the Abbey and back each day. I remember coming out of the theater at night even at like 10:30 at night, and in May, of course, there's still light in the sky. It was gorgeous. I mean, I have such fond memories. But every once and again, I thought, because by that time I had already had a history of busking. I had bused down at the St. Lawrence Market in Toronto and actually started my career there. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just try busking on Grafton Street. And it went fairly well on the most part, but I do remember one or two times pitching my busking spot a little bit too close to the flower sellers. And they were pretty aggressive about their territory, but it was fun. It was loads of fun.
Of course, not everyone, well, the Irish will know the floozy and the jacuzzi, of course, is Molly Malone. And that you were invited to compose for what would be such a traditional Irish icon and concept is a testament, I think, very much to your ability and your creativity and your wonderful performance abilities. The current album, The Road Back Home, very heavily Irish also.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, I this recording is in a way is an accidental recording. Almost a year ago at this time, it was not on our radar, but we were supposed to perform in Europe last summer. And due to the complications of COVID, I said, let's postpone going to Europe one more summer until this summer. So I had last summer quotation off. And over the years, I'd been invited by different festivals like the Celtic Festival in Godrich and Peterborough and up in Owen Sound to perform, but it's never really worked out. And I thought, this could be the summer to do that. So I grabbed my dear friends, the Bookends, who are a Celtic group here in Stratford. And I said, I wonder if we could work up a 60-minute set. You know, I could do some of the songs and you can accompany me, but you can also do some of your jigs and reels and so on. So we worked up a 60-minute set to just do those four festivals. When we came closer to the festival time, I thought, well, you know, we should probably record these performances just in case, at least for the archives. And if it qualifies for a release, then great. So we recorded, it was an afterthought to go and record them. And when we were listening to them, we said, yeah, it's probably stands up to be released as a version of a live recording or a field recording. So that's kind of how the recording came about. And really when I look back on the whole exercise, it did bring me back to that folk club in Manitoba in the late 70s and some of those Irish participants and who had introduced to the rest of us, the Bothy Bland Panksy and so on. And then going on to my travels, those early years in the early 80s to up to Donegal and Clare, all those, and it was usually in the winter time, somewhere between, Christmas and the end of February. So I'd be going through St. Bridget's Day and all of this dark, cold, wet, kind of dreary days. I'd be rambling around. And when I came across Barry Maguire's painting, this image on the front cover, I thought, oh, that reminds me of one of those years of traveling around, being so kind of a bit lonely, but looking at, you come over the mountain and down into the little hamlet or the little village and the lights are on and you go in and it's cold and wet outside, but you go in and the turf fire is burning and there's a bit of music and so on. And just the concept of people making, you know, living and being able to come together in that kind of way was something I wanted. So in the road back home involves that folk club in Winnipeg, but also those years of traveling, particularly through Ireland in the wintertime and discovering the music in its indigenous settings, which of course is mostly pubs.
I don't know if I could get a better introduction to She Begs She More or the Wild Mountainside, which we will share with the listener at this stage. And I want to come back and chat with you about your business and your altruistic work.
Great.
And that track we just heard comes from The Road Back Home, just released. And we're chatting with Lorena McKinnis. Lorena, beautiful. And you decided that, well, it's particularly has come to light in the last number of years how challenging the music industry for performing artists, and with the streaming platforms and a variety of other issues, the difficulties that performing artists has in managing or being managed, and you decided to grab the reins and go at your own.
Well, you know, I often, you know, I think part of this aspect of me running my own career and without a manager goes back to my, again, my rural roots. I grew up around a farm, did a lot of farm labor, even in the middle of the winter, feeding livestock in minus 35. But there's a kind of there's a mindset of self-sufficiency and independence that comes with particularly rural living. And I think I was sufficiently infected with that independent kind of mindset that when I found myself in this career, and of course, I always wanted to be a veterinarian. I never aspired to be a singer, that I knew I had to do it on my own terms. And as I learned and taught myself about the business, particularly from 85 to 91, before I signed an international distribution licensing deal with the Warner Music Group, I was able to finance my own recordings. I was able to finance my own tours. So by 91, I actually didn't need a deal. But I knew it would be great if I could strike the right kind of one. And I was very lucky to have a very creative lawyer to negotiate that deal. And in those travels, in those years in the early 90s, I would, to illustrate this, I would go down to Los Angeles to Warner Brothers Records. And they were always amused by this artist wandering around the building without a manager. It's had tones of children wandering around without their parents. And they were always saying, well, you really need a manager, and why don't we set you up some meeting? It was like a dating service every time I went down. And I would meet these various managers, but they never seemed to be the right kind of thing from what I was looking for. And I remember the last manager I interviewed from that standpoint, he said, he leaned back in his chair and he said, if you think I'm going to work for any artist, you've got another think coming. And I thought, wow, I bet the rest of your artists would be interested to hear that. And I realized I was just unmanageable. So I continued to teach myself and equip myself with, and I have staff. I've had staff since 91, an office. And then there were times where I had two offices, one here in Canada, one in London, England, particularly at the height of my career, which is 98. But of course, that at 98, the late 90s was the time when the internet came in, and I had released the Book of Secrets in 98 and 97. And then the next time I released a major recording was 2006. And it was unbelievable. It was just nothing but alarming to see how that part of the industry had collapsed. The whole ecosystem had collapsed because Napster had come in. There was music for free. And then Apple tried to do a better thing by charging downloads that was similar to CDs and vinyl. But then we get the streaming services that are operating in a very, very different business model. So, for example, where artists such as myself might have been paid 25 cents per song on CD and vinyl, we now get paid maybe 10 cents per 1,000 plays or 0.00013 cents on Google Play. Mm-hmm. So clearly you can't finance recordings like the kinds of recordings that I've been making. So the whole industry was broken. Half the industry was broken. And what remains is a touring industry. So of course, when a catastrophic event like COVID, a pandemic, then even touring is taken away from you. I've been very, very lucky personally. So because my career was built at the time it was, I've kept, even though the pie has shrunk, I own all the pieces of the pie. I'm not paying a manager at 30 or 40%. And I have my own team of people. So managing my career as a point of longevity certainly was a good idea. But I have very harsh feelings towards the unregulated internet. It began with respect to the music industry, but went on to has mowed down many, many other industries, including, the responsible properly trained media. There's just so many industries. But what that concern has then bled into other civic related things, like the harm it's done to children and child development, addictions, bullying, suicides, extortion, human trafficking. And of course, now we're seeing with the unleashing of AI, unregulated, a weaponizing our democracies. So these are themes that I lean in pretty heavily in my off hours.
Now, on the one hand, you have a wonderful ability to be an influencer. And yet, the very vehicle of being an influencer in this day and age is social media. And yet, you recognized that you needed to cut that umbilical cord. It was in 2018, which I know it's ironic in one sense that you have to use the snake to try to send out the message. So has that it's a positive. How now do you see that you can reach that audience without that vehicle?
It's a tricky one. And of course, one of the things that you're referring to is that I bailed out of Facebook in 2017 with over 500,000 followers. And that was after learning the role that Facebook played in the Cambridge Analytica weaponizing in the 2016 US election. And I had studied that pretty carefully and I was very, very alarmed. So I thought to myself, how can I, out of a point of principle, participate in this platform, which I know has never been explained to the public? The public does not understand the business model. The public doesn't understand most of the internet platforms' business models, which is really they pretend and they sell it for free. But a lot of it has to do with data harvesting and selling that data and in the process invading people's privacy and harming them and so on. So it was, as you say, it's like this kind of double-headed snake, because the very thing, and because they've killed the competition so severely over the past 20 years or less, I mean, the internet, even bricks and mortar retail, mom and pop shops, all the kinds of things, it's now Amazon, it's all these big platforms. And the monopoly of this is really beyond worrying with respect to our democracy. So I cherish the fragile democracies that we live in so, so very much. And maybe that comes as partially as one of the other hats that I wear, which is I'm the Honorary Colonel for the Royal Canadian Air Force. So I've spent 17 years intermingling with people who are serving Canadians in the international community every day. And yet, as a citizen, I thought I can't be participating in platforms who are constantly undermining our democracy. So there's wars that can be fought in Ukraine or wherever else. But there's a different kind of war that's actually going on right now in cyberspace. And the public simply does not really appreciate how that works and what role they can play in diminishing that risk. So it's been tricky, and there has been a price. I knew we discussed it long and hard about leaving Facebook with all these 500,000 followers, but I said to myself, the principle of it is stronger than that. And the good news is, in my case, my career is built to the degree that I can do this. This would have been a much, much harder thing had I been starting out or let's say for many other artists. But what we have talked about is, creating disclaimers saying, even though we're on this social media, you should know that this is detrimental to our collective well-being. And my mission is to actually get everybody off it until the governments around the world can properly regulate it and then build it back up upon strong, responsible principles.
Do you find that you are able to converse with influencers, that your career has allowed you to be able to knock on certain doors, and I'm thinking in terms of be it government ministers, so where you can actually try to talk this message?
From time to time, yes. I mean, it's quite interesting because my musical career and accomplishments and the honors that I've been given and so on have given me a certain credibility to have a bit of an opening for conversation. So sometimes I'll meet people in social circumstances, people, politicians that are right at the federal level or the provincial level or municipal level. And I will, you know, I remember years ago when there was a conservative government under Stephen Harper, knowing, you know, Jason Kenney and speaking with him and sharing with him my concerns about the lack of copyright reform in Canada in connection to the unregulated internet. I presented. So there is most certainly there's opportunities to offer them my witness statement, shall we say.
So, Lorena, do you then feel that people like you should use their position more to try to influence some of the detrimental issues that are occurring?
I do immensely. I am a very firm believer that our democracy does not, no democracy thrives as a spectator sport, and that we all need to become soldiers of democracy. But we do have to understand how our fragile democracies can be harmed, and there's a great deal being harmed through social media platforms right now. And although it's inconvenient and uncomfortable, I know a lot of the platforms have sold their services on the argument of efficiencies and conveniences, but there are prices. There's privacy, there's surveillance capitalism, and so on. But this harm to our democracies is huge that is coming through the door of social media. And of course, not to mention the harm that is being done to children and youth, mm-hmm. whether it's TikTok or Snapchat or Instagram or WhatsApp or WeChat or Telegram, all the rest of them. And they're heavily weaponized against civilians and civil society and our democracy. So it's getting up the nerve. It's getting up the nerve. Now, I've got a T-shirt in my bag here. I should grab it. It says, "I want the right to live an analog life."
Right. So let's,
we don't have to go back that far.
No. Let's switch gears slightly and to a little less frightening. You've done fantastic work with the Cookeries Memorial Fund for Water Research and Safety, and you purchased the Flagstaff or the Falstaff School in Stratford, and you funded the Falstaff Family Centre. And the Three Oaks Foundation also, you founded, which I think is a reflection of, I suppose, that balance that we all strive for, which it's the importance of giving back.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, this goes back to the small town of Morden where I grew up. There were not many people that were very well off. There were some poor people, shall we say, but it was a very simple existence. But one of the hallmarks of that small community, and I think it comes with when people know each other very well, is you see when people are in need, and there is this cultural disposition that is cultivated over time where you step in and you try to fill that gap, or you try to hold that person. And so when I reflect back on my own instincts to do that, I know it was shaped in those years when I was growing up, that the whole community functioned that way. And I see it in many other places. I've seen it in Ireland and Canada, other parts of Canada. So,
and I know it's we're living through particularly harsh times at the moment with homelessness and addiction, mental illness. And I know while you were able to tour a little during COVID, there were so many people who found themselves trapped and imprisoned, and it did huge detrimental damage to mental health. And that's global. It's not just, and I know often people kind of focus on the local, and it's important to try and work in the local, but it is a global issue.
Yes, certainly is. Certainly is. Yes, I mean, in that, as I say, the family center, and this is where my office is right now. I'm in this wonderful building. We're supporting the Multicultural Association downstairs, which leads with helping newcomers, Syrian people, Ukrainians, and so on. And we're doing right now, we're focusing a lot on the Ukrainian needs in ESL for all the newcomers, frankly. I mean, Canada has a very rich history of welcoming people. And the challenge is integrating everyone in a holistic way that works for everybody, including the community. But also recently, we've been working very closely with the Indigenous community, which has been very, very important. Canada is on a long and important journey of truth and reconciliation. So a few years ago, during COVID, actually, we worked with some local Indigenous people to establish a medicine wheel garden on the property. So they have gatherings there. We put up a teepee last year, and we're about to put it up again in a few weeks, around which there are activities, and certainly in September particularly. So we're working with the Indigenous community. But I think going back to the mental health, you know, if people just simply don't feel like nobody cares, if they know that just that somebody recognizes them and is there trying to give a hand, I think that can be an immense boost to people who feel they're invisibly suffering.
Lorena, I really appreciate the time. I know it's precious, and I want to thank you. And what I've heard and we've been able to share is a journey, which is an appropriate way for us to wrap up, as Lorena roped out, because I'd like to and that is another wonderful track, and you do a beautiful job on As I Roped Out. And again, the album is The Road Back Home. The website is lorenamckinnis.com. And as I always encourage, if anybody wants to get their hands on music, buy it from the artist. At least the proceeds are going into the artist and the creator's pocket. And do as much of that as you possibly can. And as I say, it was a real pleasure to be able to sit in the audience in Godrich last year. I was disappointed when I noticed your European tour. You haven't got Ireland on it this year, but I'm sure you're going back at some stage.
Oh, we would love to. And that's a whole story for another time. But we would love to. Love to come back to Ireland sometime.
Lorena McInnes, this is As I Roped Out. Thank you.
Thank you.